Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. Now, here's something you might not know. When I'm not guest hosting The Takeaway during summer break, I'm busy at my day job as a college professor. And today, we are indulging my professorial impulses by starting with a pop quiz.
What?
I promise, just three questions. Are you ready? Okay. Now, the first question is multiple choice. For every $1 of wealth held by a typical white family, about how much wealth is held by a typical black family? Is it A, 70 cents to the dollar, B, 50 cents to the dollar, or C, 12 cents to the dollar? Got your answer? Okay, now here's the next question. True or false? Getting a college degree is the best way for black and Latinx families to close the racial wealth gap. All right, stick with me, we're almost done. The last question is also multiple choice. Based on extensive research, which of these public policies would be the most effective tool for narrowing racial wealth gaps? Is it A, tax incentives to promote marriage? B, to increase the mortgage interest deduction for homeowners? C, increase the minimum wage? Or D, baby bonds? Pencils down, everyone. And with me now to give us the answers and help us make sense of them are my guests. First, we've got Dorian Warren, co-president of Community Change and co-founder of the Economic Security Project. He's also my co-host of System Check. Dorian, great to have you back.
Great to be back with you, Melissa. I'm eager for this pop quiz. I have some answers.
Look, I'm telling you, I know you do. And we're also joined by Aisha Yonduro, who is CEO of Springboard to Opportunities, a Mississippi-based nonprofit providing direct support to residents of affordable housing. Aisha, I'm so happy to have you here.
Hi, friends. Great to be here with you all.
So, Dorian, let me come to you on that. Let's go back up to that first question. Just how big is the racial wealth gap? Is it 70 cents on the dollar? 50 cents on the dollar or 12 cents on the dollar of black families to white families?
Melissa, I'm going to go with 12 cents on the dollar. And I actually think that's too high, depending on which study you look at. It could be 7 cents on the dollar, but it's nowhere near 50 cents or 70 cents. We know that for sure.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. You're exactly right. I'm not surprised. Ding, 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 right? It's 12 cents on the dollar at best, right? As you point out, and has in fact, let's just go for a follow-up extra credit here, hasn't been growing or shrinking over recent decades.
Well, my guess would be it's shrinking. And I think we have some data. If you go back just over a decade to the Great Recession, we know that during that economic downturn, white families' wealth fell about 26%, but the wealth of black families fell by 48%. And for Latinx families, 45%. So given the pandemic we have been living through over the last year and this even worse economic downturn, I would suspect, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that the gap is actually increasing.
All right. So Aisha, you sort of inspired some of this because the last time we talked, you gave me a pop quiz about what is the price of milk. Question number two, is college education the best way to close the racial wealth gap?
My answer is false.
Why?
You know, I think that we have enough data that show that Black women are the highest educated in our demography as it relates to associate's degrees and bachelor degrees and graduate degrees. But when we're talking about the wealth gap in the economy, they are still at the bottom because with wealth inequities and a lot of those realities. So I think that college education is still a myth that we tell ourselves as a way to go about closing the wealth gap. But I really think that's false.
Yes, ding, ding, ding. That's right. That is false because although it has a big impact on income, as you were just talking about, it doesn't have a great impact on wealth. It turns out wealth is a lot stickier than income, which we're going to start digging into.
Gosh, y'all are so good at this. All right, final question, and I'll let you both in on this one. I offered some possibilities for policies that could make a big difference. Marriage incentives, higher mortgage interest deductions, raising the minimum wage, or issuing baby bonds. Which one of you wants to take answering that one for closing the wealth gap?
You know, I'll start first. So my answer, I was like, this is really a pop quiz. And because I was like, you know, I could go with either the third or the fourth option with this one, but I'm going to stay on brand and advocate for cash without restrictions. So I'm going to say baby bonds. And what that is, just to, you know, do some level setting, a baby bond would be every child receives a publicly funded trust account at birth, and is aimed at decreasing the wealth gap. And the amount that individuals receive at birth would be dependent upon on the income levels of their families. So it's, you know, it's cash for families without restrictions. And I'm an advocate for that. So I'm going to go with baby bonds.
Dorian, you want to get in on this one?
I want to get in on this one because Aisha stole my thunder. So I was going to say baby bonds too. But how about this, Melissa? I'm going to add a fifth option, and that is power. Power to change the rules, the norms, and the practices that extract wealth, particularly from Black families. And that's about organizing and voting and all the things that changes the rules of our country that have led us to this condition of a wealth gap. It's intentional policy choices. And we can make other choices, as Aisha just said, in terms of baby bonds is one example.
All right, so Dorian Warren and Aisha Andura are both very much on brand today, and I think are giving us both the right answers, although Dorian is, of course, going outside the margins and giving us an answer that wasn't an option. But that's right. It turns out raising the minimum wage would be great, again, for closing income gaps, but not for wealth gaps. So Dorian, let me go to you on this, just as Aisha said, to kind of level set a little bit. Make sure everybody's on the same page about what the difference is between an income gap and a racial wealth gap.
So an income gap is when, you know, you might be working full time. I think, you know, for instance, of my sister-in-law, who works as a cook at Whole Foods and struggles to make ends meet because she has volatile hours every week. She doesn't make that much. And so when it comes at the end of the month, rent, utilities, things for her baby, it's a stretch. And we know that over half of Americans don't have $400 for an emergency. Now that's the pivot to wealth, because what wealth is more like insurance. It's there. It's a buffer for when you come on the hard times, you can draw from wealth to help cover an unexpected expense. And for those that have wealth, it is also a form of investment. You can invest in yourself. You can invest in your family. And so we have to close for sure the income gap, and especially the income gap between women of color and particularly white men. That's like the floor. But we have to go further and say, okay, but what is the wealth that people have, and what are the wealth building policies so that people can afford an emergency expense or an unexpected expense, or they can invest in their child's education in terms of college or whatever it might be?
So I love the language you used of wealth being like insurance. I sometimes think of it as like how puffy is the mattress that you're going to fall back on, right, when things go bad. If it's real thin, you still might, right, get hurt if you fall down. But if it's nice and puffy, right, if you've got plenty of wealth there, even if it's not like billionaire wealth, but if it's, you know, if there's something good, if there's a cushion, then when you fall, it's going to hurt a lot less. Now, Aisha, I want to talk with you a little bit about that kind of cushion, because the programs and folks who you work with have very little cushion, really no cushion at all. Talk to me about the women who are part of the programs that you work with and why you are to be on brand an advocate for cash without restrictions.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And you're exactly right. There is no cushion for the individuals that we work with as springboard to opportunities. On average, our families are making about $12,000 annually. And this goes to really what Doreen was saying. They are working, but they're working jobs that are very volatile. And they're also working in jobs where, you know, they're now considered essential, but we're not paying them as if they're essential. So here in Mississippi, our minimum wage, federal minimum wage, is still $7.25 an hour. So we have individuals working full times at that
rate, and that doesn't allow you to not build a cushion, let alone to getting to wealth, let alone to just having income stability. So we are seeing the individuals that we work with working tirelessly and not having the bandwidth to actually begin to think about power building or wealth building or those pieces, because they are caught in the trap of just survival. And so in order to address that need, which is a very real need of making sure that you just have the resources to tend to your day-to-day pieces of your life based on what it is that you're saying that you need it, we launched the Magnolia Mothers Trust a few years ago. And what the Magnolia Mothers Trust is, it's a guaranteed income project that we started in 2018, and it provides $1,000 a month for 12 months, no strings attached, to extremely low-income Black mothers that live in federally subsidized affordable housing. And for us, it was so important to center the needs on Black women, because we recognize, you know, if we're talking about wealth inequities within this country, so much of the inequalities that we've seen have been shouldered majorly by Black women, with our income disparities, with our wealth gap, with the way in which we roll out resources. And we wanted to say, you know, what would it look like if we put Black women in the center of joy and liberation, and not so much pain and degradation, which is a lot of times the narrative in which this population has to live out.
So I love that. I want to connect it back to Dorian's point about power, right? And this idea that, which, you know, again, you've sort of moved us to this whole other space of thinking about how we engage as citizens, as residents in the context of a democracy to change the rules of the game. So Dorian, maybe talk to us a little bit about how middle-class wealth, right, full stop, in fact, got built initially as a result of power and choices made by citizens and government.
Well, I'll give you two quick examples, Melissa. A federal policy that in many ways built white wealth in this country and extracted Black wealth. So if you go back to right after World War II, and there's plenty of political science and historical research on this, the federal government advanced very low interest loans, but excluded Black folk. So an FHA loan, if you were white and you were working class or low income, you get that loan, buy a house, build your wealth, Black folks excluded. And then you add in that whole housing industry with and the rules that structured the housing industry. So redlining that kept Black families out of particular neighborhoods where they could have built wealth. That was federally sponsored legislation. Or I know we've been talking about education a little bit. It's not the magic bullet, but the GI Bill. The GI Bill for veterans that came back from World War II and other wars and other conflicts, access to essentially free higher education that Black folks were also excluded from. So those are just two of many examples. I could go on, Melissa. We could add in the criminal justice system and mass incarceration, fines and fees in terms of local policing. It's wealth extracting, particularly from Black communities. And so these are government policies. Policies are always choices. They're always choices. And so we can make different choices. And that's what I mean by power in terms of civic engagement and having the power to change the rules, the norms, the practices that have extracted wealth from Black and Latinx communities and have benefited white communities.
Are these the plans that are going to make the difference in the racial wealth gap?
There's got to be more. It's a good start. It's a good start. So we heard just this month that the Biden administration has promised to take action to address racial discrimination in the housing market. And we've talked about housing as one of several pathways to build wealth. And we know that housing has been such a source, particularly housing discrimination by the industry, of wealth extraction and preventing particularly Black families from building wealth. So it's a good start. But Melissa, there's no magic bullet here. We need all the options on the table. So, you know, universal health care. We know Black and brown people are more likely to hold jobs that don't offer health care or paid sick leave, risking them losing their jobs. And then people get bogged down with medical debt or student debt. We know that Black college graduates owe an average of $25,000 more in student loan debt. We can cancel student loan debt.
Can the church just say amen on student loan debt? Okay, thank you.
Exactly. And just to toss out one more, public goods. We have grown up in the last 40 years with this notion that somehow the private market is better at providing public goods than government. And that is just false. So if you take childcare, for instance, Everybody should have access to high quality, affordable childcare. As a country, we have made the choice not to do that. Now, we can make a different choice in this moment, but imagine if parents, and particularly working class and middle class parents, didn't have to pay for childcare. That's more money that they could use to build wealth. So there are a range. And again, this is, I'm just name checking three of probably 18 different policies that will get at the roots of the racial wealth gap. It's not just about closing the racial wealth gap. It's about getting at the roots of how the gap comes to be in the first place.
So Aisha, I want to come to you because the one piece, one of the reasons I really wanted you here in this conversation is, on the one hand, we can look at the power of public policy, federal and state, to make these kinds of policy differences that Dorian is talking about. But I also have always been a little suspicious of, a little worried about the ways that sometimes government-based programs and interventions also come with all of these moral, ethical strings, these assumptions about who people living in poverty are or how that help ought to come with some rules associated with it. So Aisha, talk to me about the other piece of this, which feels to me like how to also ensure that folks who are on the receiving ends of these policies are empowered to make the choices in order to build their own wealth.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. And that's the reality of it. So much of the federal support in a lot of instances comes with restrictions. It's punitive. Our social safety net is very punitive. And what that means is that every time that you have an advancement in one area, there's an immediate decrease in other areas. And we have gotten to the place with the American people that we tie into that narrative that that's the way the system has to work. And it's also tied to this ideal of deservedness. Who deserves all of those pieces that Dorian was just talking about as it relates to decreasing the wealth gap? And the reality is we associate poverty with moralism. We believe that individuals should be working, built into this narrative of dignity as it relates to work and working really hard, and that we have to put these restrictions and these limitations on how all of these services are utilized, because poor people, is what we tell ourselves, do not know how to utilize the resources that they are given. So we feel as if we have to police these resources and tell them what it is that they need and how it is that they should use these services. And that's not the reality of it. The reality is that if we were to give individuals the resources that they need to not only support their immediate needs for themselves and their families, that will also lead to the greater outcomes in this power dynamic that we were talking about. And individuals will have the bandwidth in order to show up and be engaged in their local community in a way that's necessary to really seed community change and movement building. But without that, individuals are caught in a constant cycle of just having to survive. And if you are caught in that constant cycle of having to survive, where do you have the bandwidth to show up to your city council meeting or your school board meeting or to engage in any of the plethora of political movements that are necessary in order to get to effective change that's sustained? And so, you know, just as if we know that the systems, how we have them, have been designed in a certain way based on this narrative of deservedness, we can redesign that. We can have conversations about why it's important that we don't allow these governors to take away the unemployment benefits. We can design these systems in a way of how do we go about centering the conversations and the needs around those who are most impacted and making sure that they have the loudest voice and a lot of these pieces that are necessary to affect change. And right now we're not seeing that. We're seeing that the narrative is continuing along this deficit narrative based on this idea that individuals will use resources in a way that is not aligned to what it is that they need or that we have to police the resources.
I mean, that really just goes right to the heart of the reasons that I included some of those not accurate answers, like marriage, for example. Sometimes we'll hear that if people just get married, it will, you know, solve all of those wealth gap problems. And certainly two incomes help with rearing kids. But we can also see from the data that an African-American household with two incomes still has less wealth than a white household rearing children with one income. And something very similar happens around college education. Black households that are headed by someone with a completed college degree actually have less wealth than the households that are headed by white Americans who simply have a high school diploma. Here's the very last few seconds. If you had one thing you could change to help the wealth gap, what would it be? Dorian.
I would say make the rich people who don't pay taxes pay taxes and organize to change the rules.
Aisha?
Organize to change the rules, guaranteed income for everybody.
Dorian Warren and Aisha Yonduro. Y'all, this is why I love my friends. Dorian Warren is the co-president of Community Change and co-founder of the Economic Security Project. And Aisha Yonduro is the CEO of Springboard to Opportunities. Check her out down in Mississippi. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks so much, Melissa. Great to be with you and Aisha for this conversation.
Thank you both so much. This is a great conversation.
Now, the fear, loss, stress, and isolation of the pandemic has been extraordinarily challenging for our collective mental health. And this is particularly true for teens and adolescents.
Although you would expect it to be less stressful because you'd have more time to do homework, somehow I feel like teachers have been compensating by giving us more work.
For me, homeschooling has been really difficult. I've had a really hard time focusing. I've been handing in assignments late. I've been texting my friends during class. It's really quite awful.
Now there have been complaints about too much screen time at my school. So they're cutting class time down and they're dishing out more homework, which isn't great.
These are the voices of teens talking with the women's interest website, SheKnows.com, back in April of 2020, when schools had only been closed for about a month. So nearly 18 months later, the isolation and uncertainty of the pandemic, combined with the pressures to achieve and perform well during the past year, has heightened anxiety, depression, and thoughts of self-harm among teens. A recent op-ed in the New York Times reviews startling results from multiple studies showing that the mental wellness of adolescents has deteriorated significantly. And as students return to in-person classes in the fall, reporting from the Hechinger Report shows that many schools are ill-equipped to handle the decline in mental health. Joining me now is Kate Ricks, Oakland-based freelance writer with the Hechinger Report. Kate, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, Melissa.
And also joining me is Emily Esfani Smith, is a doctoral student in clinical psychology and the author of The Power of Meaning. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So Emily, can you walk us through a bit what the pandemic has meant for the mental health of teens?
So the sad facts are that there was already a mental health crisis among teenagers and adolescents even before the pandemic. Over the last decade, we've seen rates of anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidal thinking rising fairly dramatically among this group of teenagers. And what happened during the pandemic is that all of those trends accelerated. And the question is why? And you know, many teens are suffering, as we heard their voices earlier. They feel very anxious, in particular about academic goals and the pressure to achieve, which strangely has accelerated over the past 16 months. You'd have thought that the pressure would have been alleviated, but that's not what's happened. And that's been a chief cause of their mental health concerns.
It seems to be that part of what's happening in our public discourse right now is this idea that, don't worry, everything will be fine when we go back to normal. But Kate, in your recent reporting, you found that schools aren't necessarily ready to manage this mental health crisis, this increased stress that Emily was just talking about.
That's right, Melissa. What Emily was just saying about teens feeling this pressure to continue to sort of achieve under these very difficult circumstances only highlights the fact that the need for on-site mental health counseling services in public schools, because a lot of times teenagers are in some school districts, like the one where I live in Oakland, California. There are actually school-based health centers where social workers are present and teens can just walk in and make an appointment to talk to someone, and it's confidential. So if, for example, their parents are a cause of stress in their life, perhaps putting pressure on them that they can't quite meet, the counseling is there for them and they don't have to ask their parents for help finding counseling. So that, to me, the pandemic, what I found was that the pandemic has, as Emily said, only highlighted how ill-equipped our schools are to meet the need. Because, you know, I heard from a psychologist in Chicago Public Schools who said that he's responsible for 4,600 students in his school. He's the only psychologist who works in that school. And they said, you know, he said, I feel like I'm doing triage most days.
Kate, talk to me a little bit more about that sense of students feeling like they don't have the support systems that they need.
The teens that I spoke with were, many of them were actually, you know, teens who you would think would be aware of whatever supports their schools had. The teens that I spoke with included a student vice president in Las Vegas who was unfortunately, you know, lost friends during the pandemic to actually drug overdoses. And this teenager was, you know, informed that their friend had passed away. And then there was really nothing that the school could do to support. There wasn't the staff available to provide grief counseling for students who had lost friends. And this teenager in particular, Caden McKnight, who I quote, wasn't even aware that there are some apps. For example, the district had put in place some apps to help students monitor their mental health that would trigger staff at the district level if that teen reported feeling that they needed help. The teen, you know, Caden wasn't aware that these services existed. So I think that there was a sense that the services are overburdened and stretched, but also the communication to teens themselves about what's available to them during the pandemic were not adequate. And so while districts were aware, the people that I spoke with, definitely aware of the need and doing, in some cases, scrambling to put things together, the communications weren't really in place. And so I heard from multiple students reports of that they didn't know who they would even reach out to if they wanted to talk to someone.
And yet, Emily, they were getting some kind of communication, and the communication they seemed to be getting was, no matter how bad it is, you still got to achieve, you still got to accomplish, you've got to get into these colleges, you've got to get these top grades. How is it that we were failing as communities, as schools, to communicate the resources available, but we're still communicating so much pressure?
It's a great question, and it's kind of a tragic reality. I think, you know, at the bottom of it is the good intentions of teachers and of parents. A lot of people were, you know, thinking about students over the past 16, 17 months, were worried about a year of lost learning, lost milestones. And I can see with that fear in the background, wanting to encourage students, pressure students to push themselves to continue getting good grades, being involved in extracurricular activities, perhaps in an online format, things like that. But what's really striking is that, students reported in a national survey conducted by the organization Challenge Success that their parents, their expectations during the pandemic didn't, for many of them, their expectations remained the same as before the pandemic. And for many of those parents, their expectations actually increased. And so even though the parents had a sense that their children were struggling, there was still this demand to perform that was placed on them. And that was very difficult for students. Other research showed that one of the chief predictors of student depression and anxiety during the pandemic was parents' unrealistic expectations placed on their children and parental criticism as well. And I think part of why we saw that accelerating was simply because parents and kids were spending more time in the home together. And so parents were more likely to kind of be there on top of their children, making sure that they weren't, you know, looking over their shoulders on their laptops, making sure that they weren't, you know, on social media instead of paying attention in class, things like that. So there was this kind of toxic brew of parental criticism, unrealistic expectations, and students lacking the sort of autonomy that they would have had under ordinary circumstances being at school away from the household.
Yeah, I certainly said to girlfriends more than a few times that nature did not intend for us to be 24 hours a day in the house with our teens. Like, there's just no way that is good for either the parents or the kids, right? That need for autonomy and development. But Emily, just quick second on this, isn't that also in part that we tend to discount teens' feelings? We're like, well, yes, they're emotional, but that's just kind of how teens feel, as opposed to really acknowledging how troubling this time was.
I think that's right. I think that there is this idea that, you know, teenage years are hormonal years, they're difficult years, and the parent's job is to, you know, keep their anchors and keels steady and move them through this period, ensuring that they're achieving the important milestones and goals like academic goals. But of course, I think what we need to remember is that the pandemic was a national and collective stressor, a trauma. You know, as Kate shows in her reporting, many of these students lost their friends to suicide, to drug overdoses, and to dismiss the grief and all of the loss that's arisen over the past 17 years as just the normal emotional upheaval of the teenage period, I think is to do teens a real disservice. And in speaking to them, I've seen a real craving and yearning to have some sort of space and forum, whether it's at home or at school, to process their grief and these losses.
Kate Ricks is an Oakland-based freelance writer with the Hetchinger Report, and Emily Esfani Smith is a doctoral student in clinical psychology and the author of The Power of Meaning. Also, just want to note that if you have a teen who is suffering, or if you know a young person struggling right now, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. It's 1-800-273-8255. Or the crisis text line, text HELLO, H-E-L-L-O, to 741741. 741741.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC, find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway. Earlier this week, we talked about the FDA's approval of a new drug to treat Alzheimer's disease. And we discussed the search for effective treatments to slow the cognitive decline associated with the disease. All week, we've been hearing from you, sharing your experiences with loved ones who have suffered from this disease.
My name is Marceline Brown, calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. It's frustrating, my mother's Alzheimer's. She isn't aware of her significant short-term memory loss. She's paranoid, believes people are going in her assisted living apartment, unlocking her door, moving things around so she can't find them. We even put a camera in her apartment to prove it isn't true, and she finds paranoid, delusional excuses around that too, because she simply doesn't remember what she's done or doing. I'm cautiously optimistic for future patients with this drug, but it's too late for my mom. I'm sad and frustrated.
Hi, I'm Lisa from Staten Island, New York, and I just said goodbye to my sister today, who's visiting from Chicago, and we're talking about our mother who died with dementia at 65. She had a lot of other problems. And my sister always says she did not have Alzheimer's, although there was never an autopsy. And I know she had vasculitis that led to dementia, but I think it's fascinating that even though she was married to a doctor and there was enough technology 20 years ago to figure it out, that we're still arguing about what caused her dementia. So I just remarked on that, and also the fact that I have a daughter with spinal muscular atrophy, and I know that if there was an experimental drug like there seems to be for Alzheimer's, that I would be trying it. I'd be in the front row trying to use that drug.
Yeah, my name is Susan Moreno, and I'm calling from Woodbury, New Jersey. My mother died of Alzheimer's on June 15, 2013, at the age of 39. She probably had it for about 8 years. The thing that was the most cool about it was watching her evaporate. This disease is heartless, and she just literally evaporated. I can't even remember the good memories I have of her. I just have that period. I can't get to those memories for her. It's a horrible thing.
My name is Helene from Davie, Florida. My mother has Alzheimer's. She was diagnosed in 2010. My experience, along with hers, has been awful. So many caregivers who don't care, and so many specialized ALS that are specialized in poor care. Caregiving, even if it is just managing care, is draining. There is no hope. It is a disease that kills you, but your body is still here. My mother is now in what I hope is a great facility, but if I get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or any related disorder, I plan on ending things on my own terms. I may not know what is going on, but I refuse to let my children suffer.
My grandmother was diagnosed with dementia, and we lived with and took care of her for about 8 years. The last 2 years were terrible. She was often confused or scared. She also had bladder cancer, which took its toll. She ended up passing last year, but none of the medications that we used with her seemed to help.
We always love to hear from you. The number to call is 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or you can send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And if you want to hear that talk about new FDA approval on the new drug, head over to thetakeaway.org and click on Stories. You'll find it there from this week's shows. This summer, it's lights up on Washington Heights.
That was abuela. She's not really my abuela, but she practically raised me. This corner is her escuela now. You probably thinking, I'm a creek. I've never been north of 96th Street. Well, you must take the A train. Even farther than Harlem.
That's right. The much anticipated In the Heights movie is finally hitting the big screen.
I hope you're writing this down. I'm going to test you later. I'm getting tested.
Adapted from Lin-Manuel Miranda's celebrated Broadway musical In the Heights, this is a love letter to New York City's Washington Heights neighborhood, chronicling the dreams and struggles, love and loss of different members of a tight-knit community. From Usnavi, a bodega owner, played by actor Anthony Ramos, to Abuela Claudia, the neighborhood's matriarch, played by Olga Meredes.
Yo, if I won the lotto tomorrow, well, I know I wouldn't bother going on no spending spree. I'll pick a business school and pay the entrance fee. Then maybe, if you're lucky, you'll stay friends with me. I'll be a businessman richer than Nina's daddy. Donald Trump and I on the links, and he's my caddy. My money's making money.
In the Heights is not only expected to be a blockbuster at the box office, it's also drawing a lot of praise for its all-Latino cast and what that means for Latino representation in Hollywood. For more on In the Heights, we're joined now by Sigal Ratner Arias, Spanish entertainment editor at the Associated Press. Sigal, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
I know for folks in New York, they're going to know the Washington Heights neighborhood, but can you tell me a little bit about what the Washington Heights neighborhood is that's being celebrated in this incredible performance?
The Washington Heights, wow, you once you see the movie, you'll understand, but it's a neighborhood filled with Latinos coming from many places from Latin America that came to the United States and settled there to following their dreams. And this movie celebrates them.
And I think for me, that's part of what I love both about The Neighborhood and about the film is that it goes into that complexity, that diversity of Latino identity and experience. Talk to me a little bit about who some of those key characters are.
Well, you yes. have Usnavi, which you mentioned. He's the main character. He's a bodega owner who dreams to go back to the Dominican Republic where he's from to fulfill his father's wishes that they came to New York temporarily to work and make some money to go back, and they never did. And now their parents are died already, and he's trying to get back and take back their little business that they own there. There are so many characters. There's the abuela, of course, that's the abuela of everybody.
She's probably my most favorite character. Tell us a little bit about her.
She's amazing. She represents the nurturing person that even if she's not the grandmother, you know, blood-related grandmother of anybody in the story, she's the grandmother of everyone. She takes care of everyone. Everyone adores her, and she's this beautiful figures. She has a beautiful scene in the movie that the producers initially didn't want because they were worried it was going to be sort of like the Feed the Birds from Mary Poppins, that everybody, it was going to be the scene that people take a few minutes to go to the bathroom or look at their phones. But it's actually one of the most beautiful and meaningful scenes.
Absolutely. Now, talk to me about the fact that this is an all-Latino cast. How rare is that for a big budget Hollywood film like this?
It's super rare. You don't see those. I've been covering the Oscars for over 15 years, and I cover the Latino part of the Oscars. There have been a few years where I don't have anything in particular or anything big to write about, and it's so sad. There are years that there's more, but especially coming from Latin America or Spain, but not Hollywood produced, and certainly not at this level. This is something huge for the Latino community. And also, this is something that represents us in a better light, in a beautiful light. We've seen many Latinos in Hollywood here and there, but, you know, very stereotyped characters. Mm-hmm. They're playing the gangsters, they're playing the drug dealers, they're playing the nannies. But this shows real people in all their colors, nationalities, different dreams, different aspirations in life, real people as we all are. We're here, and it's amazing that finally this is happening. I'm so excited. Yesterday, I saw the movie at the Tribeca Film Festival on Pier 67, and it was, I could see the George Washington Bridge from there, which is featured in the film, and it was so beautiful and exciting. I cannot tell you, I was crying the whole time.
No, I can feel it. I can feel your enthusiasm and excitement about it. And I think that for me is part of what does make this premiere so important, so relevant. And I think I also have to say, for me, I love a good musical. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just a little bit goofy that way, but when you get a musical, there's something about that capacity to connect and also the way that it remains memorable for so long.
Definitely, definitely. I agree. And it's so beautifully done by John Chu, I have to say. It was a good mix of two minority worlds coming together, the full Latino cast with a Latino story and an Asian director that's known for Crazy Rich Asians, who did an amazing job with this adaptation, I have to say. I'm very, very happy and excited for everyone to see it.
So let's talk about Crazy Rich Asians for a moment, because it does feel like both Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther were sort of foundation laying, at least in the sense that they showed Hollywood just how much audiences will flock to a cast that is not an all-white or predominantly white cast, and that shows people of color in these very, as you said, different and more sort of fully human ways. Do you see that as having laid the framework and groundwork?
Definitely. Definitely. It's part, a very important part of the puzzle here. They definitely paved the way. And many things had to happen that and also during the pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, everything helped to set, to align all the stars for this finally to happen. One thing that is incredible, and I don't know if you wanted to talk about this later, but I have to mention it, is that, you know, Hispanics are the biggest minority in the United States with almost 60 million people. And they represent the biggest part of the box office. 29% tickets sold are sold to Hispanics. Yet on the screen, they only represent 4.5% or speaking or named characters, and a mere 3% of the lead characters. So there's an imbalance that it's so outrageous, and it's been for years. And when you see those characters, as I said before, they're very stereotypical. They don't really represent us. We don't feel represented by those characters because it's not the Latinos telling their stories. It's white people writing with a little knowledge they may have or with the stereotypes they may have in their mind, these characters. So it's really, they portray us in such a bad light many times, not always, but usually, that this is very, it's like the light at the end of the tunnel. I think this will change things.
Sigal Ratner Arias is the Spanish entertainment editor at the Associated Press. Sigal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's the show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Now, if you've missed even a single moment of this show or of any other episode, it's okay. We got you. Go subscribe and follow our podcast anywhere you get audio, or find the podcast at thetakeaway.org. You can listen at any speed you want. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzita Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.